Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Holt International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. We are still exploring my local neighborhood, and this time we've walked across Richmond Bridge and turned upstream on the towpath toward Twickenham. In just a minute or so, we find ourselves beside a rather formal riverside garden. At its center is a small freestanding column of Belgian blue stone. Spiraling down from its top is an inscription. Memories flow through me like a boat flows down the river. Composed in 2017 by Issy Holton, then a 9-year-old pupil at Orleans Park Primary School. The sweet English line interlaces with translations into two other languages, French and Flemish. And this episode is about why this lovely, modest monument is here. For much of what follows, I'm indebted to the thorough and patient research of Helen Baker and the long-suffering staff at the Richmond Local History Library. At the beginning of August 1914, Germany and France went to war. The Germans, eager to fight on French territory but not to tackle the Maginot Line, the French fortifications along the border, swept into Belgium, whose neutrality had been guaranteed by treaty since its creation in 1830. The Belgian army was quickly overwhelmed and almost the entire country occupied. After the fall of Antwerp and Ostend in October, hundreds of thousands of refugees came to Britain. Among them was a French industrialist, Charles Pellabon, who'd been running a number of factories around Antwerp. He was determined to use his wealth and managerial skill to support the war effort, and he chose this leafy stretch of the Thames as his center of operations. Within weeks of Pellabon's arrival in the UK, he was in business, producing ammunition from an old boat repair shop in Teddington. But the premises were too small, and he soon purchased a disused roller skating rink near Richmond Bridge. He began negotiating planning permission with Twickenham Council to create a factory there, but he, and this seems quite typical of him, seems to have ignored at least some of the restrictions placed in his activities when permission was granted. By the middle of 1916, the one factory building had become six, and 2,000 people were making artillery shells, hand grenades, and gun parts for the Belgian army. Around 500 of the employees were women, and many more were ex-soldiers wounded in the early months of the war. The Pellabon works acted as a magnet, bringing others to the area. There were two more Belgian munitions plants in Barnes and another at the Teddington site, which Pellabon had left. But Pellabon's was the largest employer of Belgian refugees in Britain. The impact of this development, like the development itself, was enormous. Richmond and Twickenham were at least as genteel then as they are now, and while they had opened doors and hearts to refugees from plucky little Belgium in 1914, those refugees had not generally been the sort who would work in munitions or any other factories. They were as genteel as their hosts and hostesses, housed easily and unobtrusively, given upper-middle-class clothes from the back of upper-middle-class wardrobes, helped to navigate linguistic difficulties by a team of ladies from the local Cercle de Français, and entertained with charity concerts and nice cups of tea. As Pellabon scaled up production and workers began to arrive in their hundreds, that changed dramatically. Housing was an urgent and tricky problem. Not only were the numbers needing shelter increasing rapidly, the kind of shelter they could afford was not readily available in the area. Mansion blocks had to be turned into hostels for single men and women, and large houses had to be subdivided for families. That required money, skilled labor, and some complex negotiations with locals who were about to become neighbors and landlords. Although the Belgians obviously had different tastes and customs from the existing population, the tensions that arose often had more to do with class than nationality. One large property deal fell through, over the issue of laundry. The prospective landlord was unwilling to alienate his other tenants by renting to people, however deserving of patriotic compassion, who might hang their washing outside to dry. Such issues were resolved largely by de facto segregation. By the middle of 1916, whole neighborhoods, notably that around Crown Road and Twickenham, had become almost entirely Belgian. I can't imagine how the refugees felt about living on Napoleon Road, but they lived there. Perhaps they were less historically sensitive than I am. To some extent, this separation was driven by market forces. The Belgians were paid well and worked long hours. According to some letters in the local newspaper, they could afford to pay more in rent than working-class locals. But it also seems to have made both locals and the new arrivals comfortable. Houses and flats needed to be furnished, and complicated arrangements were made to provide furniture on credit to be paid for out of future wages. And since many refugee families had been able to bring few possessions with them, clothing drives, toy collections, and sewing circles were arranged. The local press publicized and encouraged a wide range of organizations and activities in support. Every local parish had a relief committee, and charity concerts proliferated. Education was an important issue. At first, Belgian children were placed in local schools, but few spoke English, and the religious education provided in English state schools was inappropriately Protestant, and to some of the more radical parents, inappropriately religious. There was an interesting concern that the children would be denationalized, and that they would have difficulty reintegrating into Belgian society and education on their return home. So a few Belgians already resident in West London organized a primary school, but it was soon supplanted by a better-funded local effort on Warrington Road, just around the corner from St. Elizabeth's Roman Catholic Church on Richmond Hill. A secondary school was established a bit later at Onslow House on Richmond Green. This seems to have been fee-paying and aimed at the wealthier families, but still had several hundred pupils. The largest school in the area was the Belgian Primary, attached to Orleans Park School in Twickenham. All these institutions were funded, at least in part, by Pelabon, and all were staffed by Belgians, including nuns. They offered instruction in English, but taught in French and Flemish, and had curricula and teaching methods which conformed to current Belgian educational practice. They were certainly not designed to help the Belgians integrate into their host community. Rather, they were explicitly designed to make the return to Belgium after the war as easy as possible. The Belgians were a very visible part of local life, and even a tourist attraction. Here are the startled observations of a visitor from central London in November 1915. Those who remember Belgium as it was 2 years ago will recognize its prototype in the Twickenham of today. A large industrial works provides the means of a livelihood for thousands of homeless people who have colonized around Richmond Bridge. So loud is the air with Walloon, I think he means Flemish, and Belgian French that it is almost a rare occurrence to hear familiar English tones. The streets are full of peasants. Men with baggy trousers, thick mufflers, and square caps. Women with folded shawls, strikingly neat heads, and outstanding skirts. And children who twice daily run over Richmond Bridge to their newly established school, the Albert and Elizabeth. There are Belgian shops, too, to which long strings of Belgian customers are attached. The little milliner, describing herself as late of Ostend, has started afresh with a window full of smart models. The charcutier displays tempting delicacies on his counter, smoked meats, tinned savories, and cheeses, while close by the bookseller and the watchmaker have opened businesses. At dinner time, the delicious odor of newly roasted coffee flies from the cafe, bravely draped with red, black, and yellow. Through the half-open door, laughter comes, and often the strains of a lively tune, sparkling and versatile, the very spirit of a cheery, never-despairing nation. Our local paper has a lovely vignette from the spring of 1916. 200 girls in white dresses adorned with flowers crossing Richmond Bridge on their way to their first communion at St. Elizabeth's. The birthday of King Albert was spectacularly celebrated in April that year. By then, the Pellebone Works had a choir, an orchestra, and theater groups working in French, Flemish, and English, and all performed for the occasion. In November, the band of the Belgian Grenadier Guards spent the day. They began at the Orleans Park School, paraded to the factory, where they were given a tour, then marched again across the bridge to Richmond Green, where they gave a public concert and were thanked for their nation's sacrifice by a full range of local dignitaries. Pellebone donated £100 each to Richmond and Twickenham charities in gratitude for their reception. Things didn't always go quite so smoothly. A St. Margaret's storekeeper complained in a letter to the paper about the disruption to his business. "The crowds of factory workers on this side of the bridge are causing a very serious depreciation of property in what was, until the war, a quiet, select neighborhood. Stalls in the streets are the latest infliction." Some of the problems were bureaucratic. Belgian doctors were working without the required registration, and when they signed death certificates, this became a legal issue, but one that was resolved quickly and, well, unbureaucratically. Pellebone himself hadn't realized that motorized vehicles had to be locally registered, was summoned before local magistrates, and paid a fine. Public drunkenness was an occasional problem, and a Belgian brothel on Hill Rise in Richmond provoked some unsurprising disapproval. It was, I think, raided by the police in the summer of 1916, though the account in the Richmond and Twickenham Times is very coy. But the paper's weekly columnist responded with a sharp defense of the refugee community. "There are many thousands of Belgians in this locality. They are not here from choice, but from necessity. English hospitality and sympathy drew them. Strange laws and customs, unfamiliar food and drink, scanty and expensive housing accommodation have had to be contended with and overcome. And I have yet to learn that the people of this sturdy and independent little nation have, per thousand, bulked larger in the list of lawbreakers than the native population. A comparatively few motorists and motorcyclists break the law in this district oftener in a week than the entire Belgian population have done since they came here." Inside the Pellebone Works, there were some problems too. In September 1915, a worker died in an industrial accident. The factory closed for his funeral at St. James's Roman Catholic Church in Twickenham, which was attended by at least 1,000 mourners. His body was interred in the local cemetery, but the grave was temporary and unmarked, since the plan was to return the body to Belgium after the war. There were also occasional thefts from the works. In July 1916, Arthur Lamys, a Belgian, was charged with stealing a dozen drills. His defense, that he needed the equipment to set up his own business, was not enough to save him from imprisonment. One of the company bookkeepers was even more criminally entrepreneurial. Gustav Hombroek embezzled funds for years to maintain a secret household with a soprano he met at one of the works' charity concerts. He wasn't caught until 1919, and since he was sentenced to 5 years hard labor, he must have been one of the last of our local Belgians to return to their native land. Less romantic were the recurrent industrial disputes at the works. Although British unions had agreed a moratorium on industrial action until the end of the war, Pellebone workers went on strike several times, though never for very long. They also seemed to have agitated for equal pay for women workers, much to the annoyance of British union officials. The friction between the Belgians and their hosts was predictable and not particularly serious. More striking was the simple lack of contact. The Belgians lived in their own neighborhoods, worked in their own factories, shopped in their own shops, attended their own schools, worshipped in their own churches, even sang in their own choirs, and visited their own brothels. The children learned English in their schools, but that does not seem to have led to more extensive contact. I can find no record, for example, of football or other sporting contests between the two communities. And Belgian businesses did not advertise in Richmond's English language newspapers. They had their own. Whenever a concert by the Belgians was reviewed in those papers, the writer expressed disappointment that so few other locals had attended, but that doesn't seem to have sparked wider contact. When the refugees began to return home, within a month of the armistice in 1918, M.C. Smeters, chairman of the Repatriation Committee, expressed his thanks in very revealing terms. "Under the protection of your laws, we have been able to maintain in England the special characteristics of our race. We have had our munitions factories, our schools, our churches, and our newspapers. In other words, we are grateful that you hosted us, but didn't bother us." That grave in Twickenham is emblematic of the explicitly, consciously temporary nature of the Belgian community here. By the middle of 1919, almost all the 6,000 had left. The schools closed, the shops of St. Margaret's became English-speaking again, mussels disappeared from the cafes, the handful of marriages between Belgians and locals seem all to have been lived out in Belgium, not in England, after the war. Pellebon converted his factories to peacetime use and stayed until 1921, but he was an exception, and his post-war workforce was almost entirely British. When he moved to France, he left the works, gardens, and sports facilities to the local community, but not even a plaque remained to remind the people of Richmond and Twickenham of their provenance. Until that lovely pillar was erected in 2017, there was no trace. The one factory building that remained for any length of time had an extraordinary afterlife as the Richmond Ice Rink, but even that is gone now. You can find out a bit more about it in the latest Alleyway. What conclusions can we draw? I'm surprised at how easy and hospitably this huge and sudden influx of people was accommodated in Richmond. We're not so welcoming these days. The common purpose of fighting the Germans was an important lubricant, I think. I'm also surprised at the nature of the friction between the communities. It had much more to do with class than with language or culture or even religion. The absence of local anti-Catholic prejudice is quite striking. But I am most surprised at the lack of real interaction. Richmond was, as it is now, quite a cosmopolitan place, full of well-educated, well-traveled people. We welcomed the Belgians and made some sacrifices to house them, feed them, clothe them, and give them work, but not many of us got to know them. That seems like a missed opportunity. Well, that's enough for now. Thanks for listening. This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Patreon subscribers can find out a bit more about the Richmond Ice Rink and our latest Alleyway. Our next episode will end the season with a bang, or at least some very loud sounds, as we explore the role of Richmond in the early years of British rock and roll. Expect to meet some very young future superstars: Mick Jagger, Pete Townsend, Eric Clapton, Rod Stewart, the Jimmies, Hendrix, and Page. I could go on, and to visit the splendidly named Eel Pie Island. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.